This call is being recorded.
Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. It is February the 9th, 2021. This is one more of my ongoing series of podcasts dealing with many current events, all things Americans abroad, including tax issues. Today is going to be a very interesting topic with two very interesting guests. Today we are going to be talking about how the United States manages to extend worldwide taxation, that is their own tax rules, to citizens and residents of other countries. And are you ready for this? To actually get the other country to agree to impose U.S. taxation on its own residents. And yes, this will be about what is known as the savings clause. And I have with me to discuss this extremely technical but interesting topic, Karen Alpert, who has been on many podcasts from Australia, and Tim Smith, who is in Massachusetts. And I'm going to invite each of you to introduce yourselves before we get started. Karen, introducing yourself.
Oh, thanks, John. My name is Karen Alpert. I'm from Australia, and I'm the founder of the Fix the Tax Treaty website. That's at fixthetaxtreaty.org.
An interest in treaties, to be sure. Tim?
Yes, I'm Tim Smith, and I'm from just north of Boston here in Massachusetts. And I've been kind of an unofficial behind-the-scenes advisor, policy wonk, to the different organizations I've been fighting citizenship-based taxation for the last 10 years, ADCS. Now I've done some work here with Stop Extraterritorial American Taxation. And I've also done some work with some of the Accidental Americans groups out of Europe. And I've traveled down to Washington, D.C. several times. Kind of in a policy advocacy role on behalf of the affected populations in this problem or this area of law.
Absolutely, and Tim's contribution and commitment to this should not be underestimated. He is an unsung hero of life in the battle against citizenship taxation, and perhaps should do a blog post profiling your work and you at some point. But today, we're talking about treaties. We're talking about the savings clause. And let's begin with, we all know what a treaty is. It's an agreement between two sovereign nations. Therefore, a tax treaty would be an agreement between two sovereign nations regarding tax. But what's interesting about U.S. tax treaties is that it contains a provision called the Savings Clause. And let's begin with Karen. Karen, could you describe in a general sense what the Savings Clause is and what it's designed to do?
Yeah, so thanks, John. Basically, what the Savings Clause is it's a little bit in the where the treaty is talking about who it covers, that says, oh, but wait, if you're a U.S. citizen, most of this treaty you can't use anyways. And there's a couple of little things you can, but if you're a U.S. citizen, forget that there's a treaty. Essentially, that's what the Savings Clause does.
Okay, now by way of example, I'm looking at the Canada-U.S. tax treaty here. And I would like to actually read what the clause says into the podcast. Now, in a moment, I'm going to ask Tim to suggest how this might vary from some other ones. But this is under Miscellaneous Rules, Article 29. And what it says is, except as provided in paragraph 3, nothing in the convention shall be construed as preventing a contracting state from taxing its residents as determined under Article 4, residents, and in the case of the United States, its citizens, including a former citizen whose loss of citizenship had one of its principal purposes, the avoidance of tax, but only for a period of 10 years following such loss. etc. And then, as if there were no convention between the United States and Canada with respect to taxes on income and capital. Wow. That seems to say that as long as you're a U.S. citizen, you're not going to get the benefit of these treaties except in very narrow circumstances. So, Tim, I'm going to ask you if you would agree or disagree with this interpretation, the effect of the savings clause here. Would you agree, therefore, that the effect of the saving clause is to essentially guarantee double taxation for U.S. citizens?
Yes.
And then relax it in narrow areas? Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Karen, would you agree with that?
Yeah, that's pretty much what they're saying. We have the right to tax the citizen regardless of how they're being taxed by their country of residence.
Now, incredible.
I will qualify that slightly, though, John, because they do allow a foreign tax credit. However, that can be an inadequate remedy.
Very briefly, Karen, could you give an example of how it could be an inadequate remedy?
Well, if the two countries define the income differently. You know, one's taxing, say, a corporation, and the other's taxing the shareholder. Or one's defining a trust income one way, and one's looking through the trust and taxing, you know, the same income, but they're using a different definition or a different timing.
What about transition tax, GILTI, all that good stuff?
Exactly. Yep.
Amazing. So there are some narrow areas where there are carve-outs. In other words, where U.S. citizens can get the benefit of the treaty, but by and large, they don't. And this is interesting because most people understand tax treaties as the prevention of double taxation, but the U.S. tax treaty is actually to facilitate double taxation. Tim, now I use the U.S.-Canada example that I read in. You would agree that different treaties have different versions of the saving clause?
Yes, it's especially
for that.
Yes. Well, if you go back to some really old treaties that's still in force, the treaty between the U.S. and Greece hasn't been updated since 1950. The savings clause in that treaty essentially only applies to U.S. citizens. And there's actually an interesting argument you can make, I think, with that treaty, which is quite valid, which is the terms used in the treaty should be defined by what they meant when the treaty was signed.
Okay, that's a great thought. Let's hold that for one second, because I think that warrants almost a separate discussion. Can I ask you to just, can you identify any other differences in sort of savings clause on a country-by-country basis? For example, we've talked about this before, and I think the last time we talked about this, you made the point that there are some treaties where the savings clause is reciprocal. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's probably of the ones the U.S. has entered into, I would say probably the majority are reciprocal. However, there are some significant countries where it's non-reciprocal. Canada is one. France is another one. I believe Switzerland is another one too. In terms of ones where it is reciprocal, I believe Australia, it's reciprocal. The United Kingdom, it's reciprocal. The example, Greece, it's a very old treaty, but it's reciprocal also. So I'd say the majority of them are reciprocal, but there's the Netherlands is reciprocal, I believe, too. But there are some significant ones, such as France, such as Canada, that are non-reciprocal.
But of course, because only the United States has citizenship taxation, for all practical purposes, this is a provision that benefits only the United States. Would you agree with that, Karen?
Yeah, absolutely.
But of course, if other countries were to adopt citizenship taxation.
So it's interesting because I went through the Australian tax treaties. And there's actually one other Australian tax treaty that has a savings clause in it. It's the Philippines.
Yeah.
Because when the treaty was negotiated, the Philippines had citizenship-based taxation, but they don't anymore.
And that's also the Canada-Philippines treaty also has a savings clause like that. And that was actually, there was some talk of challenging the Canada-Philippines treaty on the grounds of it violating the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms just before the Philippines switched away from that. Switched away from citizenship-based taxation. So the issue kind of became moot, but there was actually some discussion in the mid-1990s of challenging the Canada-Philippines treaty as violating the rights of Philippine citizens within Canada.
Which there certainly are a large number. Interestingly, every country that has had citizenship taxation has abolished it. Is that correct, Karen?
Yeah, except for the United States.
Well, you know, I guess it only works effectively if one country has it.
Yes.
Well, it only works effectively if you have the bargaining power to force your treaty partners to accept a clause that disadvantages their own residents and takes from the treaty partners' tax base.
Well, it certainly is extraordinary that in signing these treaties, these partner countries, and you tell me if you think I'm misstating this, but these partner countries have actually agreed to allow the United States to impose its tax system, lock, stock, and barrel, on the citizens and residents of the partner country solely on the basis that they were born or naturalized in the United States. Would you agree? Yeah.
Yes.
It's incredible. And the effect of that, of course, we see through most recently, I think through themes like a transition tax and GILTI, is that what this is doing is allowing the United States to siphon productive capital out of these other countries. Am I missing something here?
Well, that's certainly happening. But I think even more of a problem is that they're handicapping the U.S. citizens, most of them dual citizens, who are living in the treaty partner country, so that those citizens cannot plan for their retirement, run small businesses, etc. I think that's a bigger problem than the capital flow.
Well, it may be a bigger problem, but what's interesting is that the first problem, the capital flow, is essentially an attack on the treaty partner country, a direct attack on the treaty partner country. And what you're describing, Karen, is an attack on the individuals inside the country, right?
Right.
So, I mean, this savings clause is one powerful weapon. Right, it attacks both the country and it attacks the residents of that other country. Now, Karen, you mentioned that it's handicapping individuals living in, say, Australia. Could you expand a bit on the examples? Perhaps just give a few so
makes yeah. It so easier. It means that U.S. citizens living in Australia, and the last census, 55% of the U.S. born population in Australia. We're also Australian citizens. So we're talking about dual citizens here. We're not talking about temporary, American expats. And these people can't take full advantage of superannuation because the U.S. has yet to explain exactly how superannuation is taxed. And for a lot of people, if they make extra contributions, those can be taxed punitively. And if you're a U.S. person living in Australia, you can't invest your money in Australia unless you're very, very careful not to get involved with passive foreign investment companies.
Which is basically impossible. I mean, you know, anything that's foreign is either a PFIC or a CFC. I mean, that's basically, you know, the way.
Be very careful to purchase listed companies that are active businesses so that you don't have a controlling interest.
This is unbelievable. I mean, what you're describing sounds to me as though not only is this, you know, imposing U.S. taxation on people who live in other countries, but it sounds to me, Karen, as though the rules of taxation are far more punitive than are applied to U.S. residents even. Is this true?
This is definitely true.
So in other words, the United States is the only country in the world that has citizenship-based taxation. All the other countries in the world, when their residents move to another country, stop taxing them. The United States taxes them worse. Is that correct?
Yeah, because everything that they buy where they live is now foreign to the U.S.
Unbelievable. I mean, this
is
shocking.
The U.S. is basically trying to get everybody all U.S. citizens to invest inside the U.S. But for an Australian investing inside the U.S., they're buying foreign assets relative to Australia.
Well, does Australia have particular reporting requirements or different taxation requirements?
The main difference is that if you buy a managed fund or a mutual fund that's not Australian domiciled, then you don't get the flow through capital gains treatment on the distributions. It's all just income.
Okay, so there are negative tax impacts.
Yeah, there are. They're minor relative to the passive foreign investment company regime, but there are negative.
Well, you know, this is one more example, though, where, you know, these U.S. tax rules are operating to effectively encourage capital moving outside these countries to the United States, right?
Right.
So, to keep track of this treaty, though, where they agree to this. So not only is the treaty partner country allowing for the U.S. to impose worldwide taxation according to U.S. rules on its own residents, its own dual citizen residents, but it's also agreeing to let the United States impose even more punitive tax rules on them than they would pose on their own residents in the United States.
Yes, although I think the U.S. would argue that, I would tend to agree with that.
Well, the U.S. would argue that anybody with foreign assets is going to be treated punitively. But come on, if you live in Australia, you're going to buy Australian assets.
Yeah. So. I mean, the U.S. could have tried to insist, for example, that any U.S. citizen living in Australia would be completely exempt from Australian income tax. I mean, there's actually probably people who would propose that in Washington. But clearly Australia, I don't think, would go along with that today. And I'm not sure would have ever gone along with that idea.
People in Washington who would propose a rule saying that, well, one of the benefits of U.S. citizenship is that only the United States can tax you, that no other country can tax you?
Yeah, I'm sure there's, I mean, maybe not now, but I'm sure 30 or 40 years ago, there were people who would have argued that.
Wow, this is amazing. So why do you think, you know, every time I hear somebody talking about these tax treaties, they say, well, you know, the tax treaty is there to prevent double taxation. I mean, how can they say these things with a savings clause there? Why do they interpret it this way?
I'm not sure how. I mean, I think probably the benefit for the treaty partner country is for let's say Canadian residents who are not U.S. citizens, who invest in the United States, they do get benefits. They get reduced withholding rates
on
U.S. source, and because they're not U.S. citizens, and because Canada has a treaty. If they resided in a country that didn't have a treaty, they would be essentially paying full freight on withholding tax on any U.S. source income.
Okay, now this seems
these treaties are negotiated with corporations in mind only.
Yes.
And yes. Anything they do to individuals is, or any benefits they give to individuals is because corporations want investors from overseas. Corporations want to be able to send employees overseas.
Yes.
And this is why these benefits for individuals are in there. They're not to be fair to individuals. They don't come to the treaty negotiation process and say, how can we make this system fair for individuals who live in one country and have income in another? That's not the point of view.
Yeah, I think that clearly must be correct. Now, let's sort of move this. Let's do a bit of an add-on here. So the problem I think that we identify is citizenship taxation, right? So savings clause applies, of course, to citizens and residents, but only the United States has citizenship taxation. Now, all treaties, as far as I can see, everywhere in the world have residence tiebreakers, right? So that you're not subject to being a tax resident of more than one country. Now, let's start off with this question. Would you agree that it is the savings clause that makes it impossible for a U.S. citizen to use a tax treaty tiebreaker to cease being a U.S. tax resident? You would agree with that?
Yes.
Yes. The residence tiebreaker is never one of the little exceptions to the savings.
But a green card holder can use the residence the tax treaty tiebreaker, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. For generally most of them, yeah.
Generally speaking. Okay.
Generally speaking, yeah.
All right. Now, thing about workarounds here, just a possible workaround. If green card holders are entitled to use a residency tiebreaker, would a possible change to the treaty to allow citizens, for example, who were dual citizens and resident in the other country to use a tiebreak, would that solve a problem? What do you think, Karen?
It would go a long way to solving the problem, but it wouldn't solve it completely.
If you were asked to propose the text of a residence tiebreaker rule, a citizenship tiebreaker rule, how would you describe it?
Basically, it would be putting kind of a dominant nationality concept into the treaty by saying that where someone is a citizen of both countries, the citizenship that counts, that they'll be treated as only a citizen of the country that they're resident in.
Yeah, something I will add, though, is that citizenship can already factor into the existing tiebreaker text. It's just a factor. I mean, I think that where the tiebreaker becomes, the U.S. wants the right to tax someone who's a U.S. citizen in Canada that has no, who basically lives in Canada 365 days a year, who has no property in the U.S., who hasn't just lived in Canada 365 days a year, has done that for 5 or 10 years. Tiebreakers
Or since they were 3 years old.
Yes. Yeah. Tiebreakers really only become an issue where you have someone who is, a U.S. citizen who lives in Canada 6 months of the year and then comes back to the U.S. for 4 months of the year. And you're trying to decide, well, are they real? And they were originally born in the U.S. And you're trying to decide, well, are they really a Canadian tax resident? Or are they really a U.S. tax resident? The savings clause kind of bulldozes through all that. You mean, so even cases that are quite obviously, who are not even in question of the tiebreaker really having having to go deep into which connection is greater. The savings clause just overrides all of that.
Yes, but I think an interesting part of all of this is the savings clauses first came in to the U.S. Treaties back in the late 1930s.
Yes.
And the whole idea of what citizenship meant, what it was.
Yes.
The ability to become a dual citizen, all of that has changed.
Yes.
So the savings clause represents a huge mission creep in two different ways. One, in terms of what does citizenship mean? And yeah, someone who in the 1930s moved to Canada, became a Canadian citizen, would have lost their U.S. citizenship.
Correct.
Right? So that's one way that there's been mission creep. The other way there's been mission creep is the increasing complexity of the Internal Revenue Code and the increasing tendency of Congress to put in provisions to punitively tax foreign income.
Yes.
Without recognizing that the foreign income under the Internal Revenue Code of someone living in Australia is income that they're earning from around the corner, from domestic to where they live.
I think it's interesting that the originals, the CFC rules, at least the beginning of it, the genesis, was signed into law in 1962, which was after the entrenchment of the savings clause in these treaties. So to put it another way, I mean, one of the worst effects of the savings clause is in the subpart F area. And that didn't even exist at the time that these savings clauses were conceived, right?
Right.
Yes, when the savings clauses were first conceived, we actually had a unlimited foreign earned income exclusion.
Well, that's, I didn't know that, but if that's the case, that's another interesting point, right? Yeah. I mean, I think what you're both saying, and you're absolutely correct in this, is that in practical terms, the savings clause meant something totally different when it was first inserted into these treaties than it does now, right?
Right. And I think a lot of treaty partners haven't realized that this mission creep has occurred. So you write to your MP in Australia and you say, this is horrible. The U.S. is taxing Australian citizens who live in Australia just because they're also U.S. citizens. And they'll say, oh, but the U.S. has the right to tax their citizens. And we've always recognized that. Without really realizing that when they first agreed to this, you wouldn't have had so many dual citizens.
Well, not only that, but you didn't have the kind of taxation that you do. One of the things that's interesting also is that the whole idea of what taxation is changing. Some of the biggest problems for U.S. citizens living outside the United States are, what I refer to as the fake income provisions, right? You know, things like subpart F, transition tax, GILTI, phantom gain problems, PFIC problems, etc. I mean, these are not actual income realization events. These are just made up fake income ideas from the Internal Revenue Code.
Right. The inability for an individual to choose a functional currency other than the U.S. dollar is a real problem.
Something I do want to add is I think there needs to be some pushback in the non-U.S. settings when people say, well, we've always recognized the right of the U.S. to tax its citizens. That doesn't necessarily make it right.
Well, exactly. What they not always recognize is the right of the U.S. to tax their own citizens while they're while those citizens are living in that country.
Yes,
that they have not ever explicitly recognized. I think, right? I mean, you hear politicians standing up and saying, "Well, the U.S. has citizenship-based taxation." You don't hear them standing up saying, well, of course the U.S. has the full right to impose U.S. tax rules on our residents.
that are citizens who just happen to have U.S. citizenship.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, we probably should wrap this up, and we can certainly continue this discussion. Actually, before we do that, I just want to come back very quickly to Tim's point, and you know, this has been implied, I think, by Karen as well. But you know, for these treaties that were negotiated many years ago, when citizenship meant something different, one wonders if U.S. citizens living in, say, Greece or whatever, shouldn't have the benefit of what citizenship meant at that time. But that's perhaps a topic for another podcast. This has been very, very interesting, and I hope interesting and useful to listeners. So thank you, Karen. Thank you, Tim. And we will definitely pick this up again.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John, too.